Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast. It's for January 26th. It's brought to you by One World Sports. I'm John Gibson, and on this beautiful Saturday morning...
It is.
Jim Allen, how you doing, bud?
Well, it is beautiful. It is Saturday. It's beautiful because I'm inside and it's chilly outside. But enough for the weather report. I'm fine. How you doing, bud?
I'm hanging in there. No exercise this morning. I'm taking an old day.
You're exercising your right to be lazy.
Exercising my right to be old.
Wow.
Crickety. The body is getting crickety. That's what's happening.
WD-40, baby.
40?
WD-40. Yeah, because they don't have WD.
I need WD-50. I need to step it up.
Extra strength.
Extra strength is right. All right, on this week's show, we've got a chat with former Nippon Ham Fighters closer Michael Nakamura, and we're going to talk about the Hall of Fame and Atsuya Furuta's election to the Hall and the Premier 12 and more. So let's start swinging.
Ring the bases!
Okay, I get the trivia question today, which is always fun because it's usually comes to me as a surprise, like 30 seconds before the start of the show.
Oh, you finally read the notes and say, "Oh, doggone it!"
Well, I just remembered actually this time was my trivia. It wasn't 30 seconds. I was thinking about it last night and this morning. Okay. Well, anyway, so Atsuya Furuta was elected into the Hall of Fame yesterday. Or I should say he was announced. He was elected a week ago. And Furuta never played for the Rakuten Eagles, but he had a hand in their existence. Huh? And he said he was overjoyed when they won the Japan Series. And I'm not going to ask you how he helped be a part of the Rakuten Eagles, but he was overjoyed when they won the Japan Series because if it hadn't been for Furuta, there's a good chance the Pacific League would no longer be in existence.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, anyway, up to the point that Masahiro Tanaka closed out Game 7 of the 2013 Japan Series, the Eagles were one of six franchises that had competed since 1950, but had not won a Japan Series. Now there are five because Tanaka did his duty.
They have competed but have never won.
Right. So they played in the Central or Pacific Leagues, but never won a Japan Series. Okay. And that includes the Central League's Nishi Nihon Pirates, who played only in the 1950 season. Okay. So now what was the last franchise before Rakuten to have never won the Japan Series? And I'll begin this by saying every existing franchise has now won the Japan Series. All 12 of them.
And you just do this to torment me, don't you?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wake up and think, boy, what can I do to agonize John?
Via cyberspace.
Yeah.
You know, I was going to say the Keen Tetsu Buffaloes, but...
And you would be right.
Excellent. But and the reason I was going to change that was because you said all existing...
Well,
and
they don't exist anymore. They were merged out of existence.
Right.
Yes, the answer is correct, is the Kintetsu Buffaloes.
I got one of your crazy questions right.
You did indeed. Good job, man.
Wow.
So they were one of five. Interestingly enough, one of those five played in the first Japan Series. and didn't win, obviously.
And that was?
The Shochiku Robins, who were one of the Shochiku franchise was one of the founding franchises of Japanese baseball. They weren't Shochiku, but Shochiku had purchased them, I think, in 1950 and took them into the Central League, and they won the first Central League pennant. So that was it. And, of course, the Kintetsu Buffaloes leaving the league in 2004 was – going to leave Japanese professional baseball with a six-team Central League and a five-team Pacific League.
Mm.
And there was a lot of talk about merger and just getting rid of the Pacific League. Nobody talked about getting rid of the Central League. but it would have been essentially the same. And, you know, the end of the All-Star game, the end of the Japan Series as we knew it. And that the players and the fans were really up in arms about that. And one part of the strike was the Eagles coming into existence, mm-hmm, as an expansion team. and that was a lot to do with Fujita leading the strike.
Right. And the Robbins franchise became the...
They merged. Well, they really did get erased. They merged for a while with the Taiyo Whales, but that ownership group's interest fell out of that after the 1952 season.
Okay.
So they were merged. Yeah, there's some element of the Shochiku Robbins in the Taiyo Whales, but that's not the case for the three remaining teams. I'll put those on the Facebook page so people can have a look.
Okay, great. Thanks. All right, excellent question. Good. I'm glad I got it right, too. I feel good about this day.
Yeah, trivia man.
Wow, trivia man. All right, so this past week I got a chance to sit down and have a chat with Michael Nakamura. He is the half-Australian, half-Japanese pitcher who came over. Basically, he came to Japan from the United States because he was pitching in the big leagues. With some two big league organizations, and he came to Japan, and he'll tell you in the interview that he had a tryout, and he actually got taken by the drafted by the Fighters, is the way he phrased it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's now retired, and he's running in Melbourne, back in Australia. He's running what he called the Family Business, which is a softball/baseball teaching facility. I suppose it's like an academy. And his last year in Japan was 2012 with the Cebu Lions, which he spent mostly on the second team. And I remember seeing him a couple times and wanted to get a chat with him, but he didn't spend, like I said, much time on the first team. And by the time, on the occasions that I got out to Saitama and got out to Cebu Dome, he wasn't around, so didn't really talk to him much that year. The thing I remember about him that stands out in my mind was that he set the PL record for saves in 2006 with 39, and he ended up closing out the Japan series that year, that magical year that the Fighters stopped that long drought of 40-some-odd years. I think it was 41 or 47. Those are the numbers that stand out in my mind, a 40-something-year drought in terms of winning a Japan series and winning a league title and all that stuff. And he closed out that last game, and the Fighters beat the Dragons in five games up there. I remember talking to Trey Hillman's wife and meeting her in the lobby before game four of that series. And it's a 2-3-2 format, and the Fighters had split with the Dragons in Nagoya. And before game four, I'm meeting Trey Hillman's wife, and I'm saying, I'm wondering if it's going to go back to Nagoya. And she looked at me and she said, John, this series is not going back to Nagoya. And the Fighters had won game three, and they went on to win game four and then closed it out in game five. So it was a great year. It was a great situation for him then. And obviously nothing lasts forever. He ends up going to the Giants and didn't really have a good stint there. And then he'll tell you why he didn't really become a big factor for the Lions in that final year. So let's hear what Michael had to say. All right, our guest on the podcast this week is Michael Nakamura. He is back in Australia. He's living in Melbourne. Thank you very much for joining us this week.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, so you the former pitcher for the Fighters and Giants and Lions, as I recall. Any other teams did you pitch for that I didn't remember?
No. In Japan, it was just those three.
All right. So first of all, we know about the unusual spelling of your name, but how did that come about?
I think, you know, being born in Japan, you know, when you pronounce Michael, Japanese pronunciation is Maikeru.
Right.
So I think that's, you know, they put the E before the A, and that's it just stuck with me my whole life.
All right. Yeah, I thought it was some interesting story about somebody at the hospital making a mistake or something like that.
No. I teased my parents that they didn't know how to spell it, but no, they were well aware. I think they just wanted to make it a bit different too. So that's how it came about.
Well, you tease them. I'll leave them alone. Now, how did you end up playing baseball in Japan?
Okay. I finished my last year in 2004 with the Blue Jays. And I came to Japan. I did a tryout with, you know, Bobby Valentine and the Fighters. And
Valentine with the Marines.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Yes. And after that, my tryouts went well, and I think both teams were interested in drafting me. And I think the Fighters just had a earlier draft opening, so I was drafted by the Fighters, and I really enjoyed it.
Now, when you went to the Fighters and you started throwing, was your role from the start going to be a relief role, or what kind of role did they tell you they wanted to put you in?
To be honest, I think they had a closer at the time, so I think I was going to be like a setup guy, a late inning relief pitcher.
But never a starter? They never looked at you as a starter?
No, not that I'm aware of. I was, you know, maybe talks had come about behind doors that I didn't know about, but, you know, I think I was always going to be like a reliever. And my first year with the Fighters, you know, I don't think we made playoffs that year, and the bullpen didn't really do too great. So I think the whole bullpen coming into 2006 was very much open, and everyone had to win a spot.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a really good, strong spring training, and I think I was given the role to close, which, coming through the minor leagues in America, that's pretty much what I did. I set up and closed, set up most of my career. So being late innings, it didn't really shock me, mm-hmm. and I really enjoyed the role.
Now, how did you approach the role? Because a lot of times when we look at closers, we look at, first of all, a guy with a fastball in the 90s, and then he pitches off of that, and that's not how you pitch.
Yeah, no. I throw, like, a lot of sliders. I throw backwards, you know, and I think the key is that I could throw any pitch pretty much in any count, you know what I mean? So keeping a batter off balanced and locating my slider,
mm-hmm.
you know, that was my key.
Okay. Now tell me about that championship run. What was the best thing about that team?
You know, coming into September, I don't think we were there, but we're right around, you know. I think it was a very close race,
yeah.
between the Hawks, us, and I think it was, you know, I think we were even at fourth place at one point, I don't know, September, the team got hot, and I don't know what happened. It was just an incredible atmosphere in the clubhouse, in the stadium, Sapporo, everything. It was just a completely, the atmosphere of the team was a dynamic.
Were you guys running off of atmosphere, or did you go out there thinking we're really good? Was it confidence? Was it talent? What was the big key for you guys there?
You know what? I think it was a lot of fun.
Uh-huh.
The team chemistry was a lot of fun. You know, we had great veteran leadership with Yukio Tanaka, you know what I mean? And then we had Ogasawara and Shinjo.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had, like, extremely phenomenal young talent. Like, you look at Darvish, and then Yagi won the, you know, Rookie of the Year. And
right.
It was just you know, then you had Tanaka Kensuke, and he was young and coming up. And, you know, with Inaba out there, and right, it was the combination between experience and just great young talent. It was a winning combination.
Well, I mean, the names you threw out there just now, they were really extremely high talent level guys, so it's no surprise that you guys were in the position you were. But now tell me about the relationship between you and the teammates. I know you can speak Japanese on a certain level, but did they treat you like a regular Japanese teammate, or were you more like a foreign teammate to them? What was that dynamic like?
You know what? I don't know. I think I fit in exactly half. Like, I would be like, I fit in with the foreigners fine, obviously, because English is my first language.
Mm-hmm. But
then, you know, I fit in with my Japanese teammates fine also, because I guess I could speak just enough to get by, and I could eat the food without any problems too. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I know what you're talking about, because I don't eat any of it.
Yeah, it's a hard thing. Like, you know, you go out to the, you know, we have a pitcher's dinner, or we do something, and we go and eat some authentic Japanese food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard to expect a foreign person to eat motsunabe, for example, you know.
Yes. Yeah, I don't eat a lot of Japanese food. Funny you should mention that. What were the conversations like then?
It was always good, because we always had an interpreter. Like, I always take an interpreter when we went to eat.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, so, you know, if I couldn't get by, and, yeah, the funny thing was, like, guys like Ejiri and...
Ejiri, yeah.
Yeah, and Tateyama, like... They're very clever. They're very clever guys, not just great baseball players, but they're clever. And they studied English, and they could speak a little bit. So between the lost context, we could make it up, you know, somehow, you know? So it was never really a problem.
Yeah, it sounds like a fun situation. Now, what about Trey Hillman being your manager? obviously you could go directly to the manager and you had the language ability to communicate exactly what you wanted and you knew everything that he wanted.
Yeah, no, Trey was outstanding. You know, he gave me a chance and I guess I ran with it, you know what I mean? I think Trey managed the team well on and off the field. I think he was a very, very smart man.
Oh, obviously. I mean, I remember a reporter from the States came over and was following him around during that 2006 Japan Series situation, and the guy was writing that Trey was a rock star. You know, he was treated like a rock star, and the media loved him, and the team loved him, and the city of Sapporo and the entire area of Hokkaido loved him, and all the fighters fans nationwide. I mean, it's too bad that he didn't win a couple of Japan series, but I think he was, yeah. And it's too bad he didn't do well when he went back to the States. I don't know that he had the team necessarily that could win a bunch of games. But who were some of the guys other than the pitchers who you had really good relationships with on the team? Some of the Japanese players, yeah.
You know, like you look at Morimoto, Inada, Inaba-san, even Shinjo, Tsuboi-san. You know, like Tsuboi-san, we're friends on Facebook now.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it's just, you know, even, you know, Kaneko-san, Nakajima-san, you know, he's now coaching.
Right.
You know, I think everyone was great. That fighters team, it was a family, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Even after that series when Nakajima-san came out to Australia, you know, he came to my house, I took him sightseeing. You know, it was more than just office. I think that's what made the team win and strong.
Wow, that's great. Now, I know your time with the Giants, your role changed, and then the whole situation was just different. What was the biggest thing that was hard to adjust to when you went to the Giants?
You know, like I went from, like, closing... to, like, I started off, my first game was pretty rough. I didn't start my very first game well, you know what I mean? And then I came home for the birth of my son, and at that time, I think my role dramatically changed. You go from, like, sitting up and closing to long relief, or, you know, I didn't know when I was going to pitch, and I pitched out of a role that I'd never really done before.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the minor leagues, I was never really a long reliever, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I'd come in and go for an inning, two innings, and I'm done. And you know, going to that role, you kind of lose confidence in yourself a little bit, and you feel like you've also, you know, they've lost confidence in you in a way, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it was just, you know, like, I guess it was just different, you know. And they had a lot of young talent that was extremely strong also, you know. So I understand, like, coming, now that I'm finished, I understand their point of view that if you're not going to get it done, you've got to get someone else who will. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same sense, I don't think I ever really had my feet settled, you know. Yeah, I started off rough in, 2009? And then, you know, I finished 2010 with a 1 ERA, then the following year I started in the minor leagues.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like, what... I guess that I never felt comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's a key. If you don't feel comfortable, you it doesn't breed success.
I noticed that, and then you ended up going to the Lions, and what was the situation there?
You know, I kind of knew going there. That's why it was a decision. I already kind of had a discussion with my wife, and it was going to be my last year. So I'd already looked at it, like, you know, I think I had a good run, and I was ready. I had two children, and I was away from them a lot, and I've been gone since I was 18, from home half my life. I'd been went away,
right.
You know, and I think I just got burnt out. Honestly, you know, I'd had enough, and I think a part of the decision to going to the Lions was, you know, should I go up or down? The stadiums are both in the same place. I don't have to relocate. You know what I'm talking about?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, the
so
farm team is...
It was pretty much, you know, maybe I'd already kind of... not. How can I say? A guy like me, I got to be 100% in. And I think towards the end of my career, I might not have been 100% in. I was looking at it like, oh, this could be my last year.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, it's understandable, and it was certainly an adjustment for you. Certainly, in you're playing in an area you're not familiar with a bunch of guys you didn't know, and it's a difficult adjustment. I understand that. So, what's your advice for Australian players who are looking to leave their home country and play abroad professionally?
Be prepared for how can I say a lot of be prepared for the worst, but expect the best. How can I say that? It's like when you're not expecting any adversity and you think everything's going to be great.
Hmm.
You won't succeed. I think when you've got to be realistic and you've got to be prepared for a situation that's going to make you uncomfortable, that you're not going to feel well, I think that part of it is very important. Going overseas, it's like don't ever take it for granted. When you get a chance,
mm-hmm.
Live each moment, because you don't know how long your ride's going to last.
Right. All right, so do you still keep up with what's going on in NPB while in your retirement here?
Sometimes. That first year, no. I was burnt out, I think. Baseball, I wanted to stay away. I did take a year off, relaxed, just enjoyed life. I visited back to America and just kind of sat back and enjoyed that 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And then once a year was over, I kind of reassessed my situation. I know I still love baseball. There's no doubt about it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's just that I think, yeah, now it's different. I'm enjoying what I'm doing. I'm enjoying coaching. I'm enjoying being around with children, so it's good.
All right. Well, we invite you always to check out our Facebook page, and I try to update it. And as soon as the season starts, I'll be more active on it and let people know what's going on. And there's Twitter and all that stuff. So we hope to hear from you again in the future. And thank you very much for taking the time out to chat with us today.
Not a problem. And yeah, I wish you the best for the coming season.
All right, and hopefully we'll see you down there in Australia sometime.
Yeah, you might see me in Japan. I'll be over there one day.
Okay. All right, bud. Take care. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you, Michael. It was good to hear you. I don't think we've spoken really since you were with the Fighters.
Yeah. Oh, you haven't. I did a story on him.
No, I had to wave. Michael. I want to wish, actually, when this podcast is released, I wish Michael a lot of good luck. Because it wasn't a case of I didn't want to talk to Michael or we weren't in the same place at the same time. It was Michael had the Jinx Jones.
I remember. Who else had that situation with you?
We'll get to that in a little bit later.
Oh, okay. All right.
But all right. Mike had this thing about when he was with the Fighters trying to get the record, and all the reporters were beating on him. You gonna get the record today? Hey, you going to get the record today? It's like they're two-year-olds. Are we there yet? Are you there at the record yet?
Yeah.
He was like going, let's see. Are we going to be in a situation that I can save tonight? Good question. I think he blew one save in that stretch. And one of those saves that he blew was on a night when I was there wishing him well before the game.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, or I guess as you can guess, I'm about close to 6'3", and I wear a hat. I kind of stand out from the Japanese reporter crowd. So when Michael blows a save, he thinks, well, geez, who is that big foreign guy wishing me well today? Let's leave him out of the equation. And so for a couple of years, he didn't talk to me.
Oh.
Apparently, there was another time which he pitched poorly after we spoke. I think that was the first game at the Giants, his first Giants game.
Uh-huh.
Or it was before that, perhaps. But anyway, he decided that I was bad luck for him, so he avoided speaking to me. So I would like wave at him from across the field, and he'd go, oh, yeah, there's Jim. Good. I think he's a safe distance. I don't think he can infect my statistics from here. So anyway,
Jim
good luck.
Allen infection.
I'm not gonna do anything to jinx you.
Good.
So
that's good to
hear. I got the jinx button off on my Mac this morning. So,
well, other than that, I got the jinx button.
So other than that,
what stood out for you in the talk?
Well, Yeah, really, really, Michael, I do. It reminds me of the first time we spoke at Cebu Dome when he was with the Fighters. And unfortunately, my IC recorder wasn't working, but we had a great talk.
It was an IC recorder.
Could have been. At Cebu Dome, it was in the preseason, and it could have been an IC recorder. The place is an icebox. Anyway, so he told me about his name, and he gave me a different story. I think he's got a bunch of different stories for that, depending on his mood. But yeah, he's a very thoughtful guy, and that always comes out when you speak to him. He's a very normal guy. You know, he's not like – there's no bit about, you know, when I was a big leaguer, we did things like this. It's always, you know, what he's – you know, he's in the moment. He's with the team. He's focusing on what needs to be done now, not what's been done in the past and what's going to be done in the future. And, of course, great words of wisdom, you know, for people come into Japanese baseball, you know, which is prepare for the worst and expect the best, which is ironically, that's what I tell people when they go to Germany and Austria to eat sausage. So right. It's kind of a double
edge. There.
You can use that in multiple situations.
Yikes. All right. Well,
yikes. That's enough punishment. What about you, John?
Well, the chat was really fun for me, and I wanted to say thanks a lot to Michael for sitting down and taking the time to chat with us. I had so many questions, and I didn't want to take up his entire day because I could have asked him so many questions. And, you know, everything stood out for me, but obviously the first thing about his name and the unusual spelling, and I had thought that somebody at the hospital messed it up, and I had heard someone else say that they decided to that the parents decided to spell it wrong.
That's what he told me. He said his dad decided. He said people are going to get it wrong anyway. Let's spell it that way.
Yeah, but I mean,
but that could have been a joke too.
Yeah, yeah. You know, when he touched on his debut with the Yomiuri Giants, and you know, I remember that game because I went to cover it, and he came in with in a save situation, a one run lead, and gave up a couple of base runners, and then a base runner and then a home run or something like that, and then another home run, and all of a sudden they were losing, and it was kind of weird because I never really saw a lot of people hit the ball in the air against him so much. You know, they might pull the ball down the line or get it over an infielder, but you know, not home runs. Just one of the worst debuts you could have as a closer role, and I'm sure this is not the case, but it just seemed like the Giants never really gave him another chance. It was a one and done situation for him in the closer role. And so then he went into a situation where he wasn't really setting up. He was kind of the seventh inning guy. And I did a story. I went out to do a story and I said, what's the biggest adjustment? And he said, hey, look, before when I would come in as a closer, it didn't matter if I gave up a run or two runs, if we had a 3-run lead, as long as I got the save and we got off the field with the win. And for me to come in and they're berating me because I gave up a run or something happened and a run crossed the plate, because it's not always the pitcher's fault. You know, they were putting a lot of pressure on him, and it seemed like he just was never comfortable in that situation in with the Giants. And then I thought he only spent 2 years with the Giants. It looks like he spent 3 there, and I don't remember him doing much in that third year on the first team. And then, you know, he was with the Lions, and as he said, I guess that was big for me, was the burnout statement, because, and this is something that I think about with all these guys like Tanishige and Inaba and Atsuya Furuta, all these guys who play more than 15 years, it's the mental stress, you know, of having to prepare and stay and try to stay physically ready. And at this point, there's no off season. A lot of the Chunichi guys are going to the Dominican and playing winter ball and all that stuff. So, I mean, there's just year-round baseball, and that mental stress has to be the biggest thing. And so that burnout statement was big for me. And I, you know, you look at these guys like Masahiro Yamamoto, and you try to figure out how he can do this for 30 years.
Well, it's the racing cars, you know, in the off season.
The racing cars let him release stress.
Yeah, him and Tom Yamazaki, they got to do their racing around.
So yeah, those were big deals for me. Those you know, I just remember that situation and the Giants, and it seemed to carry over with the Lions, who at one point made him a starter, if you recall.
I don't recall.
Yeah, I think they tried to find a role for him, and they tried to do something, get him into a situation where he was comfortable. And I think we see that this mental preparation and the mental side and you being mentally ready to go in and compete each time is so important, because he just didn't have it.
Well, it's important, it shouldn't be a revelation that it's important in baseball. It's important in everything, except that most of us work in jobs where if we have a bad day at the office, if we forget something or we make a mistake, it's not in tomorrow's newspaper. Well, I mean, except in your
case. I was going to say,
if we call that a newspaper, it's...
Stop it.
Long story. So anyway, it's generally not being talked about on the nightly news.
And not people standing over your shoulder yelling at you about it. It's usually just your boss.
Right.
Strangers.
Yeah. Right. I don't think it requires more focus to be a professional baseballer, more attention to detail, but it's a much more public, you're out there in front of everybody failing, not behind the door, not behind closed doors, not being within the walls of surrounded by your friends and not your enemies. You're on the field with everybody. So, but again, you're right. I think that the mental grind of doing the being prepared every single day for that arena, for that gladiator's arena, is different. I mean, we all have to be prepared, but we're not all, like I said, throwing ourselves in front of the lions, or the blue wave for that matter.
Yeah. And one other thing he told me was that he had some real difficult adjustments in his roles with the Giants that concerned his preparation and his workouts, because he said he had his own routine and he had his own thing going, and that the Giants were essentially a challenge for him to do all the things that they wanted him to do the way they wanted him to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something, you're getting ready for a game and your game preparation and your physical preparation. You would think that these guys could manage it on their own, that they don't need the team to come in and say, okay, well, you need to do this and that and the other.
Right. That's kind of a classic issue with Japanese baseball. I think it's a classic issue with the Giants. Warren Cromartie's book, Slugging It Out in Japan, a common theme. In fact, it's like every other chapter is the Giants coach coming up to Warren Cromartie and telling him, we're playing on an artificial turf field today, so be careful about this and be careful about that. And today's pitcher throws a lot of change-ups, so, be careful about the wind. The wind's blowing to your left today. And someone like, hey, you're right, it is. I would never have figured that out. Have played 20 years in baseball, that the wind blowing in one direction would make me, so there's that bit about over-preparation. And the other thing, which is kind of interesting about Michael's time with the Giants, is the Giants were a funny organization a superb organization in so many ways, but they had so many hang-ups.
Mm-hmm.
They've got hang-ups they're like a case for Dr. Freud. Baseball Freud is what they need. They've got, you can't do this with the Giants, and they've got rules against this and rules against that, and no chewing gum and no facial hair and no this and no that. And one of the rules they used to have was that we're not going to let our closers be very good.
What are you talking about?
they had this thing. They had this organizational stigma about relief pitchers. So they never quite – when they had relievers, the relievers were never good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were always changing them, and they were always assigning – and if you were really good, they wouldn't make you a reliever. They wanted you to be a starter. So they went through a long time in which no Giant – it wasn't until Mark Kroon about 8 years ago, the Giants had a pitcher who saved 20 games in 2 years in a row.
Yeah.
And then and Uehara set a record with 30, and then, of course, that's gone now. But it was amazing. I mean, Kroon beat that record, but they'd always have a real – the pressure on being a Giants reliever, because the pressure for the Giants, as a lot of Giants players will tell you and a lot of commentators will tell you, is not about winning. They talk about winning a lot, and I believe Hara thinks so. Tatsunori Hara, the Giants manager, believes it's all about winning. But the pressure is, in Japanese baseball, is about not losing.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to tie, but you lose. You can't lose. And, of course, the closer, it doesn't surprise me, the closer being the visible source of a loss when he blows a save.
Right.
And the fact that people, very few people have succeeded as Giants closers.
Mm-hmm.
That mentality where blowing saves is a part of the game, you know, has helped. Hara has helped quite a bit. Hara tends to be a very positive guy compared to previous Giants managers. And I think that's helped the Giants quite a bit. But the Giants, when they acquired Nakamura, it seemed that they had given up on the idea that they would have their own closers. And they were beginning to import former saves leaders from the Pacific League.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, they had Toyota,
right,
who led the league in the payroll and saves with the Lions. They had Masahide Kobayashi, who had led the Marines. They had Nakamura, and I think they had one other guy. I think they had four former Pacific League saves leaders on their team. And none of them were doing the jobs. It was weird. It was that, you know, let's just get more. Let's get them all.
Let's get them all.
Yeah, like who's still active? Then we'll go after the Central League teams.
Just adding to the collection.
Yeah, and that was the thing. And he never felt, obviously, you know, as he said, never felt at home in that collection.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. The other thing that stood out for me was the dynamic, and I really wanted to know that, and I'm hoping that we can eventually talk to one of the players who speaks a lot of English.
Mm.
But the dynamic with him and the Japanese players, because you know, he has the Nakamura name, and he's got some of the language skills, probably more so than some of the other foreign players who have been
right
here, but not completely.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was interesting how he'd go to the pitcher's dinner meeting and bring the interpreter with him.
Mm-hmm.
But how the guys, I like how he said they were clever. I like the word clever. And you know, and again, the guys he was rattling off, you know, Tateyama.
Well, Tateyama gets everybody. Everybody likes Tateyama.
I know. You know, the guys he named, these are all very successful guys. And I just wanted to, you know, as soon as he talked about that, I started thinking, oh, man, it'd be great to be a fly on the wall in that situation and watch those guys interact and communicate and have a good time together, because they all work. I mean, baseball's so serious, and it should be. And the guys try to have fun while they're doing it, but it's all about winning. And that's the goal for everybody. People aren't out there to say, hey, well, let's try to keep it to 10 runs tonight and get off the field in less than 3.5 hours so we can go out and have a beer. You know, that's not the goal. The goal is to win games. So it should be serious. But, you know, these guys are, the camaraderie is really big for them. And you could tell as he was talking with about those guys and how I think he really had a good time in that situation. And it wasn't just his success. It was the whole team's success that fed more success. But that was a really talented team. We could see why they were in the Japan Series.
Yeah, of course. I was interested in your comment. You know, it's like, who would have thought they wouldn't be successful? You know, who wouldn't have thought they'd been successful? But, you know, so many of those guys were successful, sort of were names because of their success.
Mm-hmm.
As a part of that success. I mean, as he said, Kensuke Tanaka was just a puppy.
Right.
And Morimoto hadn't established himself. And a few of the other guys hadn't. Darvish hadn't established himself, and you know, but he did it. Well, he had established himself in high school and is something of a miscreant. Mm. But you know, they sort of made their names there with the Fighters and under Trey Hillman, and can't give enough credit to what Trey Hillman did. And one of the things Trey Hillman did and Bobby Valentine, I guess all the foreign managers try to do, is try to instill a little bit of fun into what can be an overly serious.
Overly serious.
The coach, I don't think the players are all overly serious, but the coaches and managers in Japan have a duty to the media to act like every game is, as Bob Whiting once said, speaking of the Tigers and Giants, a reenactment of the Russo-Japanese War. You know, they have this duty to the media to portray each game as life and death.
Mm.
Oh, and then at the end of the game, well, okay, get them tomorrow. You know,
right.
The game. It's today is the, you know, everything. We're going to do all we can to win. Nobody's going to say, you know, we've got 25 games. We're going to have to win a bunch of them. So today isn't the end of the world. No, today is the end of the world.
Until tomorrow.
So Trey and Bobby and them did a lot of work to give players a joy of baseball. And in the 2007 season, one of the stories that I wrote was about the Fighters ping pong championship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it was really funny. Trey told me about it, and he said, I don't want to talk too much about it with the media. You know, they'll get the wrong idea. But you'd go at Sapporo Dome, you'd go to the field, the field level in the lowest basement level. And when you walk between the clubhouses, which are closed, but you can hear inside the Fighters clubhouse, people laughing, and you can hear the ping pong ball on the table. And the champion, by the way, was current Hawks catcher Shinya Tsuruoka. He was reportedly the best ping pong player in the Fighters in 2007. So, you know, he did those things, and Japanese baseball quickly adapts an image of being too serious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, being too tight until it hurts.
Ouch.
The players necessarily aren't that, but you know, the media likes to, you know, we're serious, we're fighting. But, you know, loosen up, guys. I mean, be serious, but don't kill yourselves.
Yeah. I mean, it's just baseball.
Yeah, not that, but they sometimes forget about it.
All right. Well, thanks again, Michael, and we'll be watching out for you. And like he said, hopefully he'll be back in Japan and we get to bump into him and have a Starbucks coffee or something.
Wow.
All right. Mm. All right. Let's go on to the Hall of Fame chat and talk about Atsuya Furuta, whom we mentioned before, the former Swallows catcher and I guess for two seasons, the player manager. And he was voted into the Hall of Fame. There were 332 valid ballots, and he got 249 votes that he needed to gain entrance, and that garnered 76.8%.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the only former player who was elected, and there were two other gentlemen
mm-hmm.
whom I'm not very familiar with. One, Mr. Kazuo Hayashi,
mm-hmm.
and the other, Mr. Ryohei Murayama,
mm-hmm.
and these men helped basically with youth baseball, one helping get the Koshien tournament going long, long ago, and the other with Little League, I think it's called Japan Little League Baseball Association.
Yeah, he was one of the founding fathers of that, and he created, he was the manager of the first Tokyo Little League team, and his son told a great story about them going to, speaking of fun, told a great story of being going to Williamsport, Pennsylvania with the first Japanese, eventually the first Japanese Little League World Series champions. And in Japan at that time, baseball players weren't allowed to swim.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. Maybe it was a body fat thing or something. Anyway, where's El Campanis when you need him?
Right. This is Mr. Hayashi, right? Yeah.
Right. And Mr. Hayashi and his dad said, like, hey, you know, look, we're at the hotel with all the other teams, and they're all in the swimming pool, and the kids are going, how come we can't swim? He says, well, because in Japan we don't swim. And he says, the dad says, well, win a game and you can swim. You know, it's nonsense.
Right.
There's a lot of nonsense in Japanese baseball. So his son who spoke for him pointed that out. So congratulations to him for that. And the other cat was the founder of the Asahi Shimbun,
mm-hmm. Mr. Murayama,
which was the first, which is the promoter of the National Summer High School Baseball Championship, and he was the one who essentially was behind that and the building of Koshien Stadium to house the National High School Baseball Championship.
Right.
So, the interesting thing here, a number of interesting things. I'll go over them very quickly. One is that Saito Masaki, former Giants ace, just barely.
Masaki Saito.
Masaki Saito. Excuse me. Let me get my names anglicized.
English style. Yeah.
Yep. And he missed by three votes. So he's got he's got six more years on the ballot, so he's pretty much a shoe-in for the Hall of Fame.
Yeah. And then Tatsunori Hara.
Hara got 243 of the 249 necessary votes in his last time on the ballot as a player.
Yeah, half a dozen votes shy.
Yeah, you get to be on the ballot. It used to be 25 years, and now they're decreasing it every year. 1 year every year. And it was his 21st and last year on the ballot. Mm. And he apparently was one of the top vote getters in his final time on the ballot. And apparently Randy Bass was right in that area, just barely missed election. You need 75%. So that was that.
Kazuyoshi Tatsunami,
before I give his last name first. I got 117 votes in his first time on the ballot, and Tuffy Rhodes got 85. I don't have the historic ballots from 20 years ago, so I can't really say if that's a big number for a first-year foreigner.
Right.
But it seems a lot to me that he got 25% of the votes in his first try.
Yeah, he got 85 votes. I think that's going to go up. I would assume.
Oh, it will go up. Yeah. But whether it goes to the critical point, it's such a narrow thing. I mean, Fujita was actually, there are three, as I said, we said the last time, there are three groups that select people to the Hall of Fame. The first is the writers. Mm-hmm. And the second is the Hall of Fame members, mm-hmm. the living Hall of Fame members. And the third is a bunch of experts who have, although they call the Hall of Fame members the experts, so it's quite confusifying. So anyway, the experts choose managers and former players who were past managers who are not considered by the writers. Mm-hmm. And they failed to select anybody for the second straight year. First time that's ever happened. Senichi Hoshino was on that. He got 53 votes in his first time back on the ballot. He needed 81 in the experts division.
Right,
so that'll be interesting to see whether he'll get there. Randy Bass went up from 36 to 43 votes in the experts division. But, what struck me is that there's so many, I guess we talked about this last year. There's so many good players who basically are out of the Hall of Fame.
And it's baffling, but, I mean,
the selection is, it's like a fire hose. It's a nozzle. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's so many people who should go through, but only some can. And I was thinking about catchers now. They said something to the effect that Fujita is the first player who was voted by the players' committee, the competition committee, mm-hmm. the writers voting, as a catcher. Now, the other guys were all voted in as managers, although it's kind of a feeble explanation, because Nomura was at that point, the voting was different. Nomura would have been in the Hall of Fame even if he never managed a day,
right?
Instead of winning a whole slew of pennants,
right?
So it was kind of interesting. But I think of the catchers, and I looked at their numbers of what they did, and there's so many guys who were better hitters than Fujita, and more productive at the plate and had long careers. Guys who, had they played in better hitters eras, in better hitters, well, no, I won't say hitters parks, but the Dragons catcher of the 60s and 70s, Tatsuhiko Kimata, mm-hmm. was a tremendous hitter, but he played in an era when offenses were very low scoring. He would have had probably playing, well, if he had had Nagoya Stadium now.
Yeah.
He'd be a 2,000 hit guy,
yeah.
And he'd be in the Hall of Fame. But his generation hurts him, and I have no explanation for how come Koichi Tabuchi is not in the Hall of Fame. This is a guy, a catcher, hit 400 plus home runs.
Yeah, he was.
It's bizarre. So anyway, so the Hall of Fame is the Hall of Fame, and congratulations to Atsuya Furuta.
And the thing I thought yesterday when the announcement came out, because I had no idea that I didn't think he was going to be selected, but and we'll get into it in a second here, but looking at all his accomplishments, I think he's worthy, but I just kind of didn't see it coming yesterday. But it's kind of sad that he's not involved with the Swallows right now. They could probably use him. you know, and it's the way he left, having lost, I forgot what his record was as a manager. Oh, here it is. It was 130 and 157 with three ties in two seasons. And I mean, he just didn't leave the sport the way you would picture a guy who's going to be eventually elected into the Hall of Fame. Kind of with his head down and shoulders slumped is the way he, the image that I have him leaving. But still, he'd be such a good asset with that Swallows team right now, whether he's just as a coach or as some kind of front office talent evaluators. You know, the way that Furuta looked when he started and the way he looks now, even today, and when he and as a player, you would never imagine that he would be a guy who had 10 gold gloves and was an MVP, a league MVP twice, and was a best nine guy nine times, and helped win four Japan series, and was a Japan series MVP a couple times. So, I mean, you just never think, you know, when you look at these guys, you got to be able to evaluate and see what they're going to be. And I think as a player who didn't look like a player, I think he can see those things and those qualities that are going to develop.
Well, of course, the reason he didn't look like a player is the obvious one when you see Furuta, is that he wore glasses.
Yeah, the glasses were one thing, but I mean, he really wasn't built like a, you know, you look at
Well, he was a little, he was a little skinny. He was a little skinny, but he was already, 25 years old when he was drafted. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was he was considered the premier amateur catcher in Japan when he was in college. Mm-hmm. And he was all set for the press conference for being drafted on draft day, and nobody drafted him. And that was when at some point it was the Hanshin Tigers who said, well, who would draft a catcher who wears glasses? Because
people, who can see straight.
Ah, well done, touche. So, and he was that really burned him up. And one of the the Seoul Olympic coach said, "Look, it doesn't matter. You can be a professional. Don't worry about the glasses thing." And he himself, the guy Suzuki Yoshinobu, who was there yesterday, told me about that. He said, "Look, you know, it doesn't matter." But the Tigers had made a point of it. And he was so good as an amateur, they eventually had to select him. And apparently Nomura even groused about it before the draft. Nomura was the new manager. He didn't have a lot of, he didn't have any pull in selecting the Swallows draft choices. He'd just been named when they had the draft. And he said, "We're drafting a catcher who wears glasses," said a former catcher who wore glasses.
Right.
"What's up with that?" So that really got to him. And he said that, he said so many things that I can't recap them all, but I'll be writing some stuff about that on my blog, and so we'll get to that later.
Okay.
But
all right,
okay.
Well, I do want to point out some of his accomplishments.
He
did hit more than 2,000 hits. He had 2,097. He actually led the league in hits one year. That was 1993, and he also won a batting championship in 1991. To go along with all the other accomplishments that I mentioned a little while ago. And he was an all-star 17 times. And obviously he had the talent. And when I look at all this stuff, I think definitely he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame. And I think he'll be revered in that position for a long time. So I'd like to see him get more involved in MVP. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course, and if it were America, he would probably be banished from the Hall of Fame, because he was the leader of Japan's first players' strike. he'd get the Marvin Miller treatment. This is a guy, I mean, think of how much better Japanese baseball is now than it was in 2004, largely because the players, and he said, look, it used to be an era when the owners could just do whatever they felt like, and nobody could say a thing. And the spark behind the players' revolt was the players said, "What's up with this merger between Kintetsu and Oryx? Do we get to talk about it?" He said, the Yomiuri Giants chairman, Mr. Tsuneo Watanabe, said, "Why should we discuss this with you guys? You're just a bunch of players."
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. You're only players. That era is over, thanks to Mr. Furuta.
Yep. Yeah, he made a big impact on the game in many ways.
Yeah, vastly better. Everything's better. We have two leagues. We have 12 teams. We have baseball in Sendai. The attendance is vastly better than it was in 2004. The Pacific League, which they tried to get rid of, has continued to improve by leaps and bounds. So almost everything that the owners were trying to accomplish would have gone the other direction. Or at least that's what he said yesterday. He said, you know, where would Japanese baseball be right now without the strike? It wouldn't be dead, but it might be on more life support than it is now.
Okay. All right. Now I'd like to move to the Premier 12, this tournament that they're going to have in November. And it was announced this past week as well that the grand opener is going to be played at Tokyo Dome. Mm-hmm. And then Japan and Taiwan are going to co-host this event. Mm.
Which is new because we knew about that a few months ago, but the original plan was that Taiwan was going to do the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. And so now we've got this event. It's going to be in November, from November 8th to the 21st, and at venues in Japan and Taiwan. And I don't know what this tournament is. Did you go to the press conference? I didn't go to the press conference.
You talked about it.
Yeah, you talked about it last year and said that it was coming up. But I didn't think it was going to be this big a thing. I thought it was a one-time deal. I didn't understand it was going to be every 4 years.
Yeah, well, this is a thing that I think this is the driving forces behind the Premier 12 are Japan and the International Baseball Federation. Now, they have the World Baseball Classic. And obviously, you know, you're going, well, we've got the WBC. What do we need this for?
That's exactly what I'm thinking.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's the thing. But you see, when the WBC started, there were a lot of issues with who's running it, which is it should be run by the biggest tournament in the world should be run by the International Federation instead of Major League Baseball.
Agreed. And that was the first thing that I thought of is that what they're doing with this tournament is trying to take Major League Baseball's hands and get them out of international competition because they're not ruining it, but they're changing it or they're fashioning it into an extension of Major League Baseball with the rules and the way the rules are set. And it's set perfectly so that Major League players can participate in the tournament.
In this one, yes.
Well, in the WBC.
The MLB set up the WBC, you know, so its players could take part. And they set up the WBC because nobody else could.
Right.
You know, that's part of the lesson Japan doesn't get.
Right.
The players don't get that.
But quite frankly, I looked at this tournament and I'm like, and they said, we want this to be the, I went to the homepage and I was looking on there it's called the International Baseball Federation, IBAF, and the IBAF president or CEO or COO or whatever.
Yeah, Riccardo, the Italian fellow.
He's saying that they want this to be the premier event. And I'm like, well, don't we have that? Isn't that the same wording I heard when the WBC came? What's happening is you're mucking this whole thing up like soccer. Like there's so many tournaments and you can't really figure out what's important other than the World Cup. And what I was told before was a WBC is supposed to be the new World Cup of baseball. So what is this thing?
Yeah, exactly. So that's the thing. That's the confusing thing is that it's like, I don't know, it's like I can't say it.
You're dumbfounded
it's like
too.
It's like elementary school musical. You know, it's like, hey, we'll do this. Wait, we'll do that.
This is
So last time the WBC was going to be the big thing. And then they said, "Wait, we've got a new big thing and it's going to be called the Premier 12." Well, if you remember in 2005, in the spring of 2005, the Japanese Players Union were saying, hey, we don't want to play the WBC in March. We want to play it in November. Bingo! We've got a tournament in November. And I think that's where this is from. Let's have a tournament in November when it suits the Japanese players. So the question is, will it do well? Yeah, I guess it could. But of course, I have a feeling that you know, the U.S. is going to take part, but who they're going to send is going to be really interesting. You know, I don't think – I'm curious to see – you know, major league teams may say we don't want our players playing in the Premier 12. You know, like they didn't want them playing in the – some teams didn't want to release their players to come to Japan for last year's games against Japan. So It's going to be really interesting. That's going to be a big thing. So who is the United States going to send this? They have to be thinking, you know, this is going to undercut the WBC. You know, they're going to need some logic. What they need is a plan to treat the Premier 12 with all due respect, you know, yeah. So they can maintain their international support of baseball for the, you know, due their 100% support. Yeah.
How much respect do they think is due? That's the thing.
Well,
and here's the other thing. They already treat the WBC like it's a stepchild. So what are they going to do with this?
That's a good question. Well, of course, and they give the Olympics 100% of their support, which means we got a drawer in a back room for the Olympics stuff. That's the best we can do. We're 100% behind it, but that's how MLB treats that stuff. And I hate to be rude, but that's the truth. I mean, I'm sorry, Jim Small, but the truth is they have not been able to figure a way out to get out of the way of their own existence. You know, they've got this big, huge, cumbersome schedule. They've got a big, huge, cumbersome game that's really interesting, but it's slow and slow, and they can't figure out how to get out of these problems. No, this is baseball. It's long, slow, and cumbersome. It's the way it should be. We've got a 162-game schedule and 75 playoff games for every team, and this is the way it should be. We can't change that. Of course they can change it. They can change it in a heartbeat if they wanted to.
Yeah.
But they don't want the willpower to change is not. I shouldn't say the willpower. They have the willpower to change if they can see a different future. There's nobody dangling a more profit and a better future in front of their eyes yet. The WBC isn't quite there yet, but eventually, yeah. Anyway. So
I just see it as devaluing the other tournaments. I don't know. You know, we're going to have the Olympics, the WBC, and now this thing. It's good that there's a lot of international competition to get some guys some experience. However, I don't think we need this. I've got to be honest.
I think we need it. I think we need it. And I think
I don't know about need. I think it's useful, but I don't think it's necessary.
Well, I think it is necessary because Japan is, as Toshimasa Shimada, who's the CEO of Samurai Japan, said, Japan's issue right now is not that, you know, the fan base is getting older. Baseball's in Japan. It's not that the fan base is getting older. That's one issue. But he said the real issue is that the player base is thinning out, which is in relative terms. And one of the driving forces between having a combined national team that stretches from the top level of the professionals to the lowest youth level is to get people thinking about Japanese baseball as a national team sport. You know, wearing the Japanese national flag on your uniform, representing your country at every age. And it's a way of motivating these kids to play baseball. Soccer has that. Other sports have that. Baseball had been very lax in this. And so I think the growth now, is the Premier 12 the solution? No. Is the WBC the solution? Perhaps yes in the future. But it's a big step, and it's one that soccer really capitalizes on, and baseball needs to. So is this necessary? Absolutely.
Maybe you're saying necessary for Japan, and it's necessary for Japan.
I mean, it's necessary for baseball, for the growth of baseball. Now,
worldwide.
What form it's eventually going to take, is this the finished form? No, it's like the sense of, you know, it's a balsa wood model. You know, it's a prototype. So, but this is the direction that needs to go, where international competition for the growth of the game, this is absolutely essential. And this is why MLB won't blow it off. I mean, they give second class treatment to their own tournament, which is fair or unfair. I don't want to comment.
It's confusing, but yeah.
But, you know, they're still stuck on our business is 162 games of MLB baseball, but that will eventually change to some degree, and it needs to change to make baseball bigger around the world. So is this tournament essential? Absolutely. What it's going to look like in 4 years, 8 years, will there ever be another one? We don't know. But yes, international baseball is going to grow out of necessity. And I think this is an important step. You know, they're sort of, it's evolving.
Okay. We shall watch it grow and evolve and develop together. Let's talk about Norichika Aoki going to the San Francisco Giants, your team. And this past week he signed with the Giants, and I think it's a good move for them. It's a good move for him. I think mutually beneficial.
Sure.
I think his swing fits AT&T Park in that he goes the other way a lot anyway. He doesn't try to pull the ball into that that vastness out in right field.
Well, he does pull the ball.
He doesn't try to pull the ball a lot. Yeah, he goes with pitches more than
More than he's outside stuff. No, but he'll basically, if you throw it outside, he'll shank it down the left field line or over the shortstop's head, and put it inside, he'll pull it down the right field line. He uses the whole field. He's a fairly good defensive outfielder. They're going to put him in left field, but he can also play right, which is an asset because that's a tough right field park. And I think once he plays there, he'll do well at it. He didn't get a chance to play, and he has played there in the past when he was with Milwaukee.
Right, right. And he said he was happy because he's with a contender and a team that's really serious about winning. And obviously he played against the Giants as a member of the Kansas City Royals last year in the World Series. He said he's needed. He wanted to go to a team where he's needed, and it's in an area that's Asian friendly. A lot of Japanese. It's an easier flight from there to Japan. These are some of the things that he pointed out. I thought it was a really perfect fit in terms of, you know, they need offense. They need someone to get their offense going, and they need somebody at the top of that lineup to do that, and somebody who plays a lot. And Aoki hasn't been injured. He's been very durable throughout his career, and I think that's a really big asset just to be out there and to go out in the left field and to play the position competently each day, and then to have quality at bats each time at the top of the lineup is really going to help their offense. So what was your idea or your first thing that came to mind when he
said that? Well, I was very happy because I do like his approach. He's very good at getting on base. The Giants said, hey, that's what we want. Bingo. It was a good fit for them. They were looking, of course, the word is always in the major leagues, if you're missing a left fielder, which the Giants are, you know, who's going to hit home runs for us? Well, I said, well, you know, they lost Michael Morse. Well, he could hit home runs for them in left field, but he couldn't play left field. Mm-hmm. So Travis Ishikawa, as we saw, has his limitations. But, you know, they were looking for this guy gives them some, you know, a skill set that they really were lacking, a guy who could play all over the outfield and get on base. So that was good for them. He apparently turned down. I'm guessing he was probably being pursued by the Baltimore Orioles to some degree and a couple of other teams. Apparently the story was he could have gotten more money. I do believe that. Because, you know, after the Nick Markakis deal, as I said, I think last time that he might have soured the market. But anyway, it was, I think, a good acquisition all the way around. So congratulations to him, and hopefully congratulations to the Giants. It's going to be tough, but good for him.
Okay. Yeah, I woke up this morning to see that Ichiro Suzuki is pretty much almost a done deal, signing with the Miami Marlins, and seems like he's going to get a one-year deal with them. And he's pursuing 3,000 major league hits. He's at 2,844 in the big leagues.
156.
So I had tweeted this early on in the talk about him going to the Marlins. I saw somewhere that basically they were discussing offering him an extra year, so making it a two-year deal. And I thought, no, I think what he wants, and this is a pretty talented outfield that they have over there with Yelich, Ozuna, and the big monster hitting Giancarlo, don't call me Mike Stanton, but I don't see him getting enough at bats. You know, I was thinking maybe they could say, we'll try to give you a start a week, and we'll try to pinch hit you as often as we can. That's probably between 250 to 300 at bats in a season, and he'd have to hit 500 to get to where he wants to be in terms of 3,000 hits this year. So I don't know. I guess if I were him, I'd take the two-year deal if they were to offer that.
Well, I can't. I can't really look into the mind of Ichiro. Thank goodness. And So, you know, I just wish him the best, I hope. But again, we never know what's going to happen. You never know who's going to get hurt. You never know what, you know, it could well be he's with the Marlins and some other team desperately needs somebody who can play right field and, you know, and bat in different part, you know, with some speed.
Mm-hmm.
And that could happen and he could be somewhere else. So, you know, you don't know what's going to happen, but because he has a skill set that's still valuable
mm-hmm.
at some stage. Now, here's the question. His defense is still valuable.
Still valuable, even if it's diminished, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But he's still well above average right field, or well, at least above average. Plus, he's an above average base runner.
Well, I haven't looked at the numbers. That's not
well. He still he can still steal a base for you. He can still run the bases well. He pretty much does everything well that he tries to do, which is hit singles, run the bases, and play the outfield. But you know, the on base, you know, when you got a 300 on base percentage for a corner outfielder, who wants that guy to start? The answer is not me.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm happy if he, you know, who I want Ichiro to play for. The visiting team when he comes to my park so I can sell tickets.
Right. Well, good luck to him. We'll see. I mean, as a fourth outfielder, I would assume he's not – obviously, if somebody gets injured, he'll be out there on a daily basis.
Yeah, he's still play. He's better than – he'll be better than most – than a lot of major league fourth outfielders. So he's going to get some playing time, and he could sneak into a temporary starting role. And who knows? You know, he could be – what he needs is just a kind of a one magical season where he gets a job and all the hits fall for him, and then a few more hits next year and he's got 3,000.
All right, let's talk about DeNA, Yokohama DeNA, the Bay Stars, slid a female into the ownership role, I guess right after our last show. And Tomoko Namba, she's 52. She's one of the founder or the founders.
Which makes her an unusual owner. That she is an owner.
Yeah, she's actually an owner. and now you've talked about this ownership role being mostly a figurative or mythical kind of.
No, it's not mythical. It's a job.
It's a
position. Every Japanese baseball team, there's no requirements that teams have general managers, but there are a number of positions that in order to fulfill Nihon professional baseball rules, they have to have. They have to have a daihyo, a team representative who attends the boards of directors meetings. They have to have an owner who has the final say on all decisions relating to the team. Even though many of these owners don't, because they're not actually owners.
Right,
but they need a person who is the owner, and they need a person who is the team representative.
So,
and then after that, they have to have a manager and players and a minor league team, and after that, they're pretty much free and clear. So the owner is somebody within the organization they put up and say, okay, you stand up there and be the owner.
Right, and so, I mean, I was thinking at the very beginning when I heard the announcement, I thought, well, this is no groundbreaking thing. I mean, she's the first quote-unquote female owner to be in this role for a team in MPB, but she's no Marge Schott, God rest her soul.
Yeah. Well, thank goodness for that. I mean,
In the sense that she's this matriarch of the entire organization. It's like you said, she's fulfilling this duty, this position on the team.
Well, yeah, well, that remains to be seen. I mean, I doubt she's going to be run. That's the thing is, well, Marge was larger than life. She wasn't longer than life, but she was larger than life.
Right.
And, you know, is she going to be that kind of character who people are going to be writing stories about because of the weird things she says? No. Does she have a big influence on the team? That remains to be seen. I don't know. There have been other female owners in the past. In MLB, but not in Japan. So I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, is
she going to be? Yeah, who knows? She could have the baseball. You know, she could. You know, she's a business person. She may. Japanese baseball tends to take business people and chew them up and spit them out.
Right.
You know, it's like this is baseball. It's not supposed to be business.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to see it.
Game. It's not supposed to be fun.
I'm glad to see it, and I don't want to downplay the situation just because it's more of a. Like you said, a job or a position on the team. But I think it really shows a progressive approach by the Central League or by a Central League team, because that's something that we haven't seen in the Central League we've always seen the PL taking on a leading role in setting trends and making innovative moves. So I think this is really good. But I hope...
Well, there are people in the Central League who are innovators. But, the funny thing is one of the big innovators in the Central League is the team president of the Omiri Giants, Mr. Kubo.
Uh-huh.
And the reason you never think of the Giants as being innovators is because they're the Giants. And Mr. Watanabe likes to, he's the Marge Schott of Japanese baseball. I mean, he's the guy who's blustering, and saying this should never happen. If that happens, we won't play. He says all these stupid things. He's a big, charismatic, interesting, a fun guy. But he also, he just says crazy stuff. And because he says crazy stuff, you don't think of the Giants as being progressive. But the team president, Mr. Kubo, is highly regarded by everybody in Japanese baseball as a real solid progressive person. And when Namba was announced as DeNA owner, he said, boy, I'm really excited because I think this is a new thing and this is something we need.
Yeah. Well, she said the first thing she said was that she wants to change or bring a woman's perspective to the baseball. And I'm like, I don't know about that, but I'd like to see you fire your manager, Nakahata, and hire a real manager and make some changes on the field and get this team up in the air where stars belong.
I don't want to name names, but there's a bunch of people in the Bay Stars organization would love to see that as well.
But yeah, instead of just making it an entertainment entertainment based organization, have it win. Try to make it a winner and do what you have to do that. But I'll be keeping a keen eye on the Bay Stars and whatever changes get made, the subtle changes or if there's some big changes, I'll assume that you're pulling some strings back there.
Well, they have been an organization since for a number of years that has tried to innovate, and they have innovated at some levels. But the whole package has been kind of a little bit of a house of cards. The structure has not been there. The organization has not been quite there. In a sense, they remind me of the Oryx Buffaloes on the field in that they've done a lot of the right things, but it hasn't worked.
Yeah.
They've always had a lot of very innovative people working for them, but the innovative people tend to get pushed out. So that they do something interesting and progressive is no surprise, but whether it works or whether it builds any traction is going to be the interesting question.
Yeah. All right. And speaking of questions, I hope we get some questions to the podcast. You can send them to yakyujohn@gmail.com, or you can leave us a note on the Facebook page, and we take MP3 questions as well. So
okay, talk to you next time, folks.
All right, enjoy your off season. One World Sports is the exclusive home of the Omiri Giants in North America and features live coverage of all Giants home games. Please contact your local cable provider to find out how you can watch One World Sports.